All right, everyone. Today is Tuesday, April 6, 2010. And while we're well into the new year, it's finally time for A2 Unplugged to unveil its year end / year beginning annual show. Aloha and welcome to A2 Unplugged, the Apple II podcast brought to you by A2Central.com, your total source for Apple II computing. Visit them on the web at www.A2Central.com by JuiceGS, the longest-running Apple II publication in history. Visit them at www.juice.gs. By listeners like you, thanks for your donations. We couldn't do it without you. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Ryan Suinaga, your host, and you are listening to A2 Unplugged, coming to you live from beautiful Kaneohe, Hawaii. Our contact information is, you can reach us via email at a2unplugged@gmail.com. You can reach us on the web at www.a2unplugged.com. And you can get us via voicemail at 808-218-2737. This is our yearly most popular, most anticipated show where we bring together some of the Apple II world's best known folks to look at our past year and our coming year. So without further ado, we'll get into it. Although I do have to apologize for some of the audio quality, which is just on my part. For some reason, there is an echo. So I realize that may make it hard to hear, but it only affects me and not the other participants in the round table. Let's get cracking and talk to our experts live on A2 Unplugged.
Let's start off with introductions. Joining us from Tennessee
is Eric Shepard, also known as Sheppy from Cinecom.
How are you today, Sheppy?
I'm good. Very good.
Okay. Thanks for skipping out on your relative's birthday party to join us today.
No problem.
Okay. And from Paola, Kansas, we have Sean Fahey of A2Central.com. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Okay. From Worcester, Massachusetts, we have the editor-in-chief and publisher of UGS Magazine. That would be Ken Gagne.
Hi, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
From Syracuse, New York, we have Ken's right-hand man on UGS. That would be Andy Malloy. Andy, how are you?
Hi, Ryan. Good. Happy Easter to everybody.
Oh, yeah, happy Easter. Happy iPad Day.
And finally, from Oceanside, California, we have from Apple2.org, Apple2.info, Tony Diaz. Tony, how are you?
All right. Could be better. Could be worse. But we're here.
I'd like to thank everybody for taking some time out of their holiday or possibly holiday weekend. To join us, and let's go ahead. We have a list of topics we're just going to do a roundtable and go around and see if people have something to say about what's happened in 2009 and anything they want to share about what may be happening in 2010. And I think this is the first time we've gotten together besides Canvas Fest and some last year. I think we had the same six of us here last year, if I recall correctly. So I thought we would start off with a whole bunch of different hardware advances that we saw in 2009. We saw at Canvas Fest, an 8-bit VGA card, an 8-bit slotted Apple II, an Apple IIc plus VGA interface.
We even saw an MP3 player that goes into a slotted Apple II, and more recently, in fact, in the latest edition of UGS Magazine, we saw the iDisc, which brings us many different capabilities, including Bluetooth and USB. Sheppy, what do you think about all these hardware advances for this supposedly dead computer?
Well, you know, it's really interesting to me how the kind of the hardware space has become the big creative arena for the Apple II in the last few years. For a long time, hardware development was just totally, totally dead, and it was all, you know, stuff in software. And I think we got to a point where it was like, okay, we've run out of the things we can do with the software. I mean, in terms of like brilliantly new stuff, and everything just sort of moved to hardware. A lot of this stuff is very cool. Anything that can be done with VGA is, of course, awesome, because it's increasingly getting more and more difficult to get like monitors that are compatible with the Apple II. Now, it's a bigger problem, obviously, with the GS and its kind of unusual video output. And it's a little frustrating that we don't have a solution there yet, although I know that it's coming down the pike. We just haven't got there yet. I'm very excited to see the development going on in terms of USB stuff, especially when it comes to using it for mass storage, but I'd also like to see it kind of used for other things as well, although mass storage obviously is kind of the big thing, disk devices and whatnot. The iDisk, I haven't tried it personally. The things I've heard about it seems like it's maybe a little bit half-baked to some extent, but hopefully the kinks will get worked out of that over the coming weeks, months, whatever, and we'll have a good solution there. So, and of course, we know of other projects also that are doing stuff with USB. The Vince's MP3 player, for example, could be leveraged as a USB storage solution as well. And so, hopefully, he'll get prototypes to people to write code for that before long. We'll see.
Thanks a lot. Sean.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Sheppy. It's been really cool to see all the new hardware coming out. There is some software development going on as well, like the VMO2 project that just got out of beta. I'm really excited about that. I think that might spur some additional development on the Apple II platform, people being able to write their Java classes and maybe open up a whole new realm of program development on the Apple II. That's kind of what I'm interested in tinkering with right now myself.
Okay. Ken Gagne, what do you have to say about this interesting area in the Apple II world?
Well, Sheppy had a pretty comprehensive perspective. I agree that in order for Apple II software development to advance, there does need to be some new hardware, which might explain the shift recently. That's not to say that I think we've exhausted the possibilities of the Apple II's native capabilities, but for example, look at everything that Ewan Wannup and Jeff Weiss did with TCP/IP, none of which could have been possible without Ethernet cards like the Lance GS or the Ethernet. I am very excited with all the USB devices out there. Not really being much of a hardware guy myself, I'm not sure if it's ever possible that we'll have a USB card that does not only storage but also USB peripherals like keyboards and mice, but I do want to see the iDisk continue to go through various revisions to correct the issues that Mike McGinnis noted in his JuiceGS review. I want to see what comes of Vince Briel's USB card, whether or not it's an MP3 player. And yeah, I'm very excited by everything else that's coming out, such as Rich Dreher's CFFA 3000, which I think Andy has actually been keeping a closer eye on than I have.
And that makes a great segue over to Andy Malloy.
Yeah, I'm really excited about how the Apple II hardware has kept up over the year. I noticed that Henry Corbis from Reactive Micro posted recently that the beta version 3 of the Apple II VGA card is just getting ready to go to beta testers. So I know there were a few kinks that they were working on that we saw at K-Fest. One of them was that card on 80-column LCDs, I think it was a little fuzzy. So I know I would love to see that card and be able to use it with LCD monitors, not have to go back to CRT, because apparently the card works well with CRT monitors. So I'm interested in that. And like Ken, I'm really happy that the CFFA is going to be revved with a new version. I think I read that it was going to be able to use SD cards, which I think would be great, step up from Compact Flash. And I guess lastly, I don't know if there's time later, but there's a few upcoming hardware projects this year that sound very exciting. The Apple IIgs laptop project that Bill Martins and others are working on And then even the ROM 05, which I hear is also percolating along from Anthony.
I have to say that I am really thrilled to see any kind of continued development on the Apple II, whether it be hardware, software, or in terms of documentation. But since I'm not very much of a hardware guy myself, I do very little soldering.
I am really impressed by anyone who's able to do this. And one of the things I was really impressed by at Canvas was the age of a lot of these developers. These are people who are very young and very knowledgeable.
I thought that was really impressive. And speaking of hardware at Canvas Fest, this was something I didn't really understand, so not just for our listeners, but for myself. There was some controversy at Canvas Fest regarding this cart launch card. So let's go ahead and start with Sheppy. I don't know if you were party to it or not. But go ahead, Sheppy.
You know, I'm really not. The whole thing going on with that has been a little bit confusing to me. I know that they had problems with it. At Kansas Fest, and I don't remember exactly what it boiled down to, but there was a lot of very mean sniping at those guys for no apparent reason that I could see, basically accusing them of making up the entire project, and I think that was a little uncalled for. Obviously, they've had some roadblocks in getting the project finished, but I haven't seen anything that indicates to me that they're like, you know, trying to screw people over or anything like that. But I do look forward to getting something to actually come out of that whole thing because really, any of these, there's so many very cool Apple II hardware projects right now, and this is one of those that sounds very interesting. And flexible. It's almost a matter of they might have taken a little too much on, if that makes sense. And it's kind of slowing things down a little. But I'm not as in on this as some of these other guys are. So I'll shut up now and let somebody who knows more about it talk.
Sean, do you have some light you can shed on this for us?
Yeah, well, the initial problem that we had at K-Fest was that the card wanted to initialize too fast and wasn't getting enough power. From the old power supplies, I guess that were in the machines we were testing it in, and that was what was causing the problem. I have two of the cards. They do exactly what they are built to do. They're rock solid. They're beautiful looking. The only problem we're having right now with those cards is there's not a lot of development going on at this time. Or maybe people have some projects that they haven't really rolled out for it yet. I guess I was hoping that with the release of these cards, we'd see a lot of, Mockingboard clones or VGA cards or, different processor, coprocessor cards, cores coming out. That just hasn't happened yet. So I guess there's not enough expertise in the community yet on how to work with these cards.
Okay. And next up is Ken Gagne. Ken, do you have much to say about this topic?
Well, I hate to be a total noob, but I'd like to pass it back to Sean and ask, you said this card does exactly what it's supposed to do. What exactly is that?
Well, it's an FPGA card where, you know, you can, with the right skill and the tools, you can make it act like another card. You could turn into a 6809 coprocessor card or a VGA card. It has that capability built into it for 8-bit Apple IIs. It could be used as a compact flash hard drive controller. It's just a matter of programming the cores to do the specific tasks.
Okay, thanks.
Anything to add, Ken?
Not really. I mean, obviously, I haven't really followed this very closely. I wasn't at the... Well, I guess there wasn't a presentation at K-Fest, but I never really was following what was happening. And I know there was some discussion about it on CSA2 after the fact, which Sheppy alluded to. But mostly what I know about it is just what I've read on Sean's website.
Okay. And Andy Malloy.
I checked recently on the Carte Blanche website, and I noticed that all 50 boards from the first run seem to have been sold. So there's, that's a limited pool of people who are going to be able to experiment, and some of those are surely just wanting to buy the card to use it and not be able to actually program for it. So I'm not sure if maybe if he gets another run of cards out, that will help spread it out a little. It reminds me a little bit of a comparison with the C1 project, which was a configurable FPGA-based computer that Jerry Ellsworth designed, and it was mainly focused around Commodore users. But that had a lot of the same issues where the boards got out there, probably, you know, at least 100 of them were out, and then people had to wait for these developers to basically program the cores. And I know, I bet development's still going on, but I haven't checked in a while. But definitely, there was some lag time, though, before people could start really using it.
Okay. And on to Tony.
Ken was asking, actually, let me rephrase that. Ken's question on what it does and what it not. You think of a big piece of graph paper or an electronic breadboard as opposed to, let me rephrase that. How many people remember those? Remember the kits at Radio Shack you could buy with the little springs on them and you could put the wires between stuff and make it do stuff?
Sure.
Well, think of the carte blanche as a million of those things on that little chip size of a postage stamp. Whatever you can think up of circuitry and whatnot, you don't have to design a card, solder down stuff. You simply load it electronically into that, and excuse me, the card provides various connection points that would be commonly used, and then there's also a strip of connectors on there that you can attach to and connect other things to. Like if you want to put a USB connector that wouldn't be there if it wasn't there, you'd stick that on there and then work electronically into the back end of it. So you know, an Etch-a-Sketch of electronics, etc., basically that's what it is. So you can design whatever you need on paper or on a computer screen and simply load it in. Don't have to run down to Radio Shack or Fry's or Norvac or whatever your brand of electronic store is and bring home a bunch of parts and sit down and solder them anymore. You can get a lot done this way. You still got to solder down stuff, but you get a lot more done in one evening this way.
Cool. Thanks.
Any more comment on that, Tony?
No, it's primarily, I guess, you know, you might want to say what happened at K-Fest. You know, a lot of enthusiasm caught up. The card got out a little too early, and the only thing I have to say that I was a little surprised at K-Fest was, great, we got this really neat-looking piece of hardware and all this stuff in a bag, and there was not one bit of paperwork with it or explanation of what to do with it. So that was kind of like surprising. And I have a little bit of disagreement on the power thing. I think that card uses a lot less power than the whole rest of the computer combined, but that's...
Well, it was a matter of
what's going on.
The card was initializing too fast. Apparently the power didn't ramp up fast enough for it to initialize correctly. So they corrected that and it now works correctly.
Okay. On to our next topic. There's been a lot of interest in trying to restore old Apple II cases, which are currently yellow with age. So recently we heard about this Retrobrite, this substance that people are using to try and restore cases, and our own Tony Diaz actually has come up with an alternative method as well. Sheppy, much to say about this?
Not a lot. I think that it's pretty awesome to be able to restore, you know, that platinum or beige or whatever color your device was originally kind of look. It's not something I have time to deal with, but I think it's awesome for people that, you know, want that look. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, Sean.
I'm learning to grow more comfortable with my yellowing equipment. I used to kind of be obsessive about keeping everything pristine and clean, and but I think it's cool that if you got time and the effort to do it, but I'm kind of comfortable with the color of my stuff the way it is.
Okay. Ken?
Well, I do most of my Apple II computing via emulation nowadays, which is something that doesn't yellow. But I did appreciate Tony's observation. Sorry?
I said, the emulation.
The emulation. I did appreciate Tony's observation at KFest that you really can't remove the color. You can just move it somewhere else, as he was a living example of.
Okay. Andy.
I've been looking at that. I haven't experimented with it yet, but maybe for those who don't know, your RetroBrite is basically you're making a gel using hydrogen peroxide, and then you mix it with glycerine and xanthan gum, and then an oxy laundry booster. And once you put out that gel and leave it in the sun, the ultraviolet light basically, I guess, bleaches out the color. And when you're done with that, you could use Armor All or supposedly use a clear acrylic varnish and coat it again to prevent the yellow from coming back. Tony, maybe I'd be interested in hearing, how is your method different than the RetroBrite method?
Okay, and there's another segue, Tony Diaz.
What I've come up with was basically sandblasting. Mm-hmm. And before everybody goes, oh my gosh, I'll provide a URL and some pictures with some explanation, but baking soda is about the finest media you can get, which is what you refer to sandblasting, which you put in the sandblaster, is you put media in, be it glass beads, sand from the beach, or whatnot. And for an example, cleaning aluminum, cleaning airplane parts, and other things that get corrosion on them, but you don't want to harm the metal, blast it with baking soda, and the corrosion comes right off, and it literally does nothing to the metal. It's so easy on the metal that you can take the blaster with 120 pounds of pressure coming out of it and point it at your hand, and it won't do anything to it. Even if you stand there for 30 seconds, it's not going to do anything to it. But it takes that, but it takes any loose particles right off the surface. And that's the difference between doing it with RetroBrite, the chemical method, and doing it by removing it, is the chemical method, I'm not all that convinced, is actually removing anything. But more like you take the hydrogen peroxide and whatnot and put it in your hair, and what happens to your hair? It turns lighter color. The natural color that's in that plastic, if you can use the word natural and plastic together at the same time, natural color of it is what is underneath that top layer. And I think what the RetroBrite is actually doing is just converting that top layer back to either clear, or it's obviously taking out color. I don't know what it's going to look like in a year or so after that. However, about this time last year, I took a number of plastic parts, some Lisa top cases that were really, really yellow, a front of a Lisa that had the Twiggy drives on it, some Apple III plastics, a 2E, some beige and platinum, as well as 2GS. Basically, I have about 15, 20 pieces of various plastic. And I went outside with a big, giant cardboard box and made a blast cabinet that would hold it all. And when I was done, I think I looked like the 80,000-year-old man, because I was all white too, because I had 5 pounds of baking soda going everywhere. But the plastic pieces are all here. They've been sitting near windows. They've been sitting out in the open. I left a couple outside for about six or so months. I want to compare them now and see what they look like a year later. And I'm thinking of offering the service in doing it. I don't know if it's going to be cheap. It's kind of a mess. It's a pain in the ass. Excuse me. Pain in the butt. Sure. But it is very messy. But what I'm basically doing is taking off a micro-thin layer of the stuff. So I'm actually removing what has come to the surface. But it's doing it in a very non-destructive way. I have close-up pictures where I've taken a piece of painter's tape and put it down on the plastic, and then blasted right along the edge and peeled it up. And if you zoom in real close, you can't even see a difference in the texture. The original texture stays exactly the way it was. So you end up with exactly how the mold made it, except that now you've got no more yellow or beige or darkening of the plastic. This does not work on smooth plastics. It has to be the textured stuff. The smooth stuff that comes out of the molds tends to be prototype and or other products. Like the Commodore 64 was textured. The surface on a Topo robot, for example, is not textured. It's smooth you got a yellow Topo robot, this won't work on it. It'll actually make the robot look like it's been sanded. Because it'll actually take off the clear coat instead.
And that's kind of what it is. It's almost like it's being sanded.
Almost being sanded, yeah. So I've got, I've got a number of pieces that I drew URLs and some words and stuff in just to see what the difference is, and probably put together a slideshow based on that and see what it looks like.
Okay. And all I really have to add to that is I'm glad that anyone who is a collector and concerned about the appearance of their machines, any kind of help he can get in preserving that, I'm sure appreciated.
Actually, one thing I like to add to that is real quick is that, like Sean said, he goes, he's quite happy just using the stuff the way it is. I might add, I'm fine with using it because now I know there's a way to make it look better if I need to have it look better. Be it Retro Bright or Blast or whatnot. So, okay, gotcha.
Okay, while we were at Rockers University for Kansas Fest 2009, over in Australia, our friend Andrew Rowan had put together the first Mount Hura Fest, an Australian gathering of Apple II users at the same time. Maybe it would have been nice to have Andrew for this part of things. But just getting opinions, see what people thought of that.
Well, I think it's awesome that they've started up an event down there. I seem to recall hearing that they're doing plans for another one this summer, although I don't recall for certain. But I think it's great. They had a good number of people show up, and they had a lot of interesting discussions, and there were some projects demonstrated there that I had never even heard about before. So, the news coming out of that was really fascinating, and I think it's awesome.
Okay, Sean.
Yeah, I think it's great that they're getting together too. I, of course, miss those guys flying up and hanging out with us. But I understand some of the projects that were kind of being worked on down there, like the IDE CD-ROM interface and software. I guess they're going to be maybe part of the ROM 5 project, so I really haven't heard any new news out of that. If I'm mistaken, I apologize for that, but that's kind of the word I got. And I'm looking forward to seeing the fruition of some of their projects, and hopefully they'll get together again.
Okay. Ken Gagne.
I think it's excellent that we're finally acknowledging that there are Apple II users not just in the United States. And I know we've always known that, but it's very hard for them to get to Kansas Fest. And especially in the past few years, we've had very few international representatives. So the fact that there's now an alternative on the other side of the world is great. They were originally considering getting together again just this past December, but I think that the connection they had at the facility that they were using had some health issues and wasn't available to help them coordinate the matter. So they may do it again this summer, and if they do, I really want KFest to have a video chat with them. We tried it last summer, and unfortunately, on our side of the lake, there was not a great internet connection. So if we can find a place to do it this summer, I think it'd be great to have that coordination going on.
Okay. Andy.
I thought it was great fun at KFest trying to get the two meetings linked up, because it was difficult, but we did have that time when we were seeing them and they were seeing us, and I think everybody was clapping and cheering. And I mean, here we are on different sides of the world on the same day, and we have groups of Apple II users still plugging along and demoing new projects and products. I'd like to second what Sean said about that, the Tron project that they talked about. Getting IDE and ATAPI links on the Apple II family to be able to use DVDs and CD-ROMs as media is really interesting to me, because before, we were stuck with SCSI card or SCSI interfaces for that. So I'd like to see if that goes forward. Apparently, that particular project uses Rich Dreher's CFFA card in order to make the hardware interface. It's not that it's going to be a new card to do it, which I guess was the developer a lot less work. He just has to work on firmware for Rich's card to get it to work. But it's something I'm looking forward to from Australia.
Okay. Tony?
Tony?
I guess I can echo the sentiments that were there. It was a bit frustrating trying to get the link going in the beginning, and I think we all just resorted to IRC and whatnot after that for a while. But I can't say that we've, you know, the international presence has been a big thing of KFest, and KFest isn't exactly new. As we know, it's going on 21 now, so it's hard to say that. But I guess from an outside standpoint, maybe they're not aware there's a lot of development going on. It is kind of cool that it's the whole platform is being discovered by people who weren't even born when you could barely buy the things, and they're discovering it, and they're getting about the same out of it as a lot of us. It's making people think and making people come up with ideas and continuing on what it was designed to do in the 80s today.
I think Australia has always kind of been a hotbed for Apple II developers way back to our friends Richard and Andrew and Ian and a whole bunch of other people.
So I'm glad to see that they can reap the benefits of getting together and not needing to come all the way to Kansas City in order to do that. Well, obviously, I think this is awesome. Lost Classics did a lot of great stuff over the years, back when Howard was handling it, and it kind of petered out there as Howard became, distracted with, real life, so to speak. So it's awesome to see Lost Classics starting to make a comeback, and obviously some of the announcements that are coming out of there, and I won't mention them here because we'll get to them later, are very encouraging. So it's fantastic. It's great.
Sean Feehy.
It's hard to add any more than what Sheppy just said. I think it's great, and I really appreciate Tony taking that on and bringing it back. That kind of stuff takes a lot of hard work, a lot of effort behind the scenes, and I think he deserves a real strong pat on the back for taking that on.
Okay. Ken Gagne.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic that Tony has taken this up, because The Lost Classics isn't just about finding the people who own the copyrights to the software, but also having a place where that software can then be made available. And I think we had gone through both of those steps before, and then, as you said, the Lost Classics project became lost, and all these programs that we had the rights to were no longer available again. And so it's great to see that software brought back and made available.
Okay. Andy?
I think it's a great project, too, all the work Tony's done. I just was looking on the site, and there's almost 80 different software packages available there. And, I mean, if you like Beagle Brothers software, if you like InTrack, if you like Paul Lutis's old Apple Writer stuff, it's there, it's free, it's legal, it's been given back to the community, and Tony's got it all organized in an easy way to get to. I think it's great to see it out there.
Okay. And Tony?
When I was, I guess, like a number of us, we were all wondering, okay, where did the Lost Classics get lost to, and what happened to it? And I finally just decided enough, and just said, I've got most of it sitting here. I'm doing it again. And one of the things I actually found was interesting is, while we had the web version over the years, we had what was on Genie, we had this Lost Classics and that Lost Classics, and some Lost Classics weren't even there. A lot of things would get talked about. I thought the original program back in the 90s was a little too limited as far as, yeah, that's great, let's get it all available. But they put so many strings on it. It had to be Protoss launchable, it had to be this, it had to be unmodified. But if you can't get the original unmodified code, then we would never release it. So it was, it was a lot of that. And I said, we're going to just make it available. However it is, we get it. And if we come across a master later, great, we'll replace it. To try to get as much available alongside with it, documentation in usable format, disk images and whatnot. And then I realized with the recent Raster Blaster thread on CompSys Apple II, I realized, okay, I thought it was on there. I went back and looked. No, it wasn't. So I dug it out, put it on there. And you know, if there's anything missing, anything gets brought up, we'll get it filled in. It's now a content management system as opposed to having to do the pages all by hand, which means a number of people can contribute to it. It's easy to make changes. Nothing's set in stone anymore. And with hosting becoming practically free and cheap and abundant, it's not going anywhere anytime soon. So.
I really have to add to that is that I'm really glad to see this make a comeback. These are titles that were once things you paid a lot of money for, and to have them freely available and readily available is a really great thing. Moving on, advances in emulation, we actually have one of the authors of an emulation program on our roundtable here. Let's go ahead and start with Eric Shepherd.
Well, obviously, you know, emulation continues to be a really popular solution for Apple II users these days, and I think that's awesome, of course, obviously. There's been a lot of kind of in between big and little stuff going on. I finally released Suite 16.2 and 2.1 over the past, you know, during last year, and continue to work going forward on it. Hopefully, I'm hoping to have another release out this coming summer that will, you know, add a few nice little features. Then I'm actually planning to do a rewrite of the user interface to redo it all into a Cocoa application, which will make upgrading it further a little easier. But it probably means that after the next major release, it's going to be a while before I get another one out. So, but I think in the long run, it'll make a lot of things better. Plus, I'm going to fiddle with, and it's unlikely that it would actually be able to be distributed, but I'm going to fiddle with trying to port it to the iPad because I think that would just be awesome.
Yeah, I agree.
Sean Fahey.
I like that emulation has gotten to the point where it's really solid. It's almost problem-free. I can just put something on my laptop and take it with me. It's really great for showing people what the Apple II can do, what the community's been up to, especially people who wrote off the Apple II a long time ago. But at the end of the day, I really prefer the real thing.
Okay. Ken Gagne.
Yeah, I think it's great how accessible emulation has made Apple II computing. And especially there are so many peripherals and accessories out there that make it even easier, like CiderPress on Windows or ADT Pro, which I recently used to make disk image backups of my original Apple II hard drives, which I had never done before. So now I know all that is saved and is accessible from any laptop Macintosh. I actually am so reliant on emulation that I put off upgrading to Snow Leopard for quite some time because that version of the Mac OS does not offer write capability to HFS drives, and I use an HFS disk image to get my files into and out of Suite 16. I love that Sheppy has started pumping out updates to this like clockwork, and it's becoming an amazing program that doesn't hog up the resources that it used to. But Sheppy, is there any intention to better integrate file transfer between the two environments?
Yes. I have a version of Suite 16 which has that work partially done. To finish it, I need to be able to run MPW again, and I don't currently have a machine that'll run it. I'm working on getting that set up, and the reason for that is that a lot of the little Apple II side GS side drivers and stuff, my code for those is in MPW for various reasons. And so I need to work on that code as part of the whole combination. But eventually, yeah, I've got it all figured out how it's going to work, and it is going to be really, really awesome once I've got it working.
Great, because that's the one feature I miss about Bernie back in OS Classic. Yeah.
Oh, this is going to make what you could do in Bernie look lame by comparison.
Okay. We'll hold you to that. Anything else, Ken?
That's all. Don't do that. Don't hold me to.
Andy.
I think the Mac users had it better in 2009 for emulation. You have Virtual 2 for your 8-bit emulation, and that's a really solid program. It was updated like three or four times in 2009, but it was all about, you know, little tweaks and little compatibility fixes. So we've got a great emulator there. Sheppy's version.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add to that. Virtual 2 is awesome, and the fact that it was, you know, the updates this past year were little ones, little tweaks, is not, you know, to say anything negative about that emulator at all. It's so good that that's all it needs. It's a very good program.
Right. It's very mature. And then Sheppy's version 2, I mean, if people haven't played with it in a while, I mean, the list of the big features that were added, just looking at them, you got networking support, full screen support, it could mount CD-ROMs, you could copy and paste text between the 2GS and the Mac environment. This is all awesome features, and now to hear that, you know, even a new version is going to take it to the next level, possibly this year, is great news. On the Windows side, we're kind of... Apple Win is one of the main 8-bit Apple II emulators, and that's a good program, and that's been coming out with regular releases. I think we had four in the last year. But 2GS development on the Windows side, I haven't seen much of that. I don't know if you other guys have, but Kegs used to be the one that I used, and it's still great, but it's definitely fallen behind some of the usability features that we see on the Mac side.
Okay. Tony Diaz.
I'm here. Okay. I guess I'm probably the opposite of Ken in one aspect. Yes, I was probably very vocal with the lack of HFS and very surprised that, you know, I guess a number of us saw it coming, but I was pretty surprised that it wasn't even noted anyplace, and it took a couple days before the release that we go, wait a minute, we don't have HFS, and I've been using MS-DOS floppies to put stuff in and HFS to bring stuff out, and I'm, you know, sitting here on the edge hoping we get some way to do it. At the same time, I've always gone,
You know, the really sicko way I'm doing it is I'm actually running, I'm running a copy of macOS 10.5 in VMware Fusion and doing my disk images, doing HFS disk images in that to get stuff back and forth. So I copy it into my emulator, running it in Leopard, and then I quit the emulator and I quit the Leopard install and start it back up in Snow Leopard again. Start up Suite 16 in Snow Leopard to use the files I just copied in. That's my workaround.
That's about as bad as the flip side of what I've got going on here too. There's a PowerBook sitting on the CNC machine downstairs, so it's got 10.5 on it, obviously. So I will all the images or whatnot are sitting on the server. I mount it up here, do what I need to do, put the files in the folder, go run downstairs, mount it down there, put the stuff in the image, unmount it, come back up here, mount it again. Talk about sneaker net. Well, let's just burn the calorie net, you know.
Yeah. Obviously, I think we could use a better solution. Yeah. Anything to add, Tony?
Yeah.
I'm just excited that, you know, emulation seems to be taking a stand again. You know, there's always the purists. I want to use the hardware and whatnot. And right behind the Mac here, I've got a desk that's back-to-back. There's Apple IIe and a 2GS setup loaded with stuff, but the emulation does fill a very good niche as far as being able to make a lot of other projects that we'll be talking about later make them a lot easier to do.
Okay. And all I really have to add myself is that I'm really angry about Suite 16 just because now I don't have excuses for why I haven't finished any code. Because now I can test all of my networking code that way. In addition to that, I am actually kind of interested in this new Candy emulator for Android smartphones. And since I might have an Android phone coming this way relatively soon, I'm kind of interested to see how that works out. Okay, we're going to kind of go out of order here on the suggestion of one of the participants in our roundtable. We're not going to lose any topics, but let's talk about something that saddened us all in early 2010, and that was hearing about the death of Joe Cohen, the owner and operator of Shareware Solutions 2, and someone who I think all of us, except maybe Andy, knew personally, as well as due to his passing, the closure of that Apple II business. Why don't we go ahead and start with Sheppy?
Well, obviously, I've known Joe for a very long time. In fact, I remember back when I first started doing Apple II programming, he was writing his Shareware Solutions column back then, back before he had his own newsletter. And it was such a thrill to see my name in print when he mentioned one of my little utilities. I don't remember which one it was anymore, but he mentioned it in one of his articles, and it was so awesome. And so I've been kind of a fan of his for a long time. And he published some of my software for a while, and he handled payments for me for a while for some of my shareware. And you know, we did a lot together over the years. And so obviously it was sad when he passed away. Even though he had kind of drifted away from the community to some extent. I mean, he was still filling orders and selling product, but he wasn't quite as actively. That was an interesting sound. He was still there, but he wasn't as, you know, kind of as active as he had been for many years. But it's still a loss for us all, and it's such a shame.
Mm-hmm. On to Sean Fahey.
Well, I didn't know Joe very well. I just recall when I first came back to the Apple II community, when I started going to K-Fest, that's where I met him, and he was kind of a legendary figure. It was obvious that he had a lot of respect, and a lot of people listened to him, and I kind of followed out around after him and listened to everything he had to say, bought all of his products. Basically, as I got to know Joe a little bit better, you know, it's really sad that we lost him, and the community owes a lot to him for a lot of the work that he did previously. I really can't say more than that.
Okay. Ken Gagne.
Yeah, Joe was one of the first people I met at my first K-Fest back in '98, and he was there for a few years after that. He was one of my first introductions to the Apple II community because I got my start on CompuServe, and he was right there recommending how to get started, you know, where to go and who to talk to. And he followed us to other services like Genie, Delphi, and Syndicom Online. But as everybody else said, he wasn't very active lately, and I actually just pulled up my email archive, which goes back to 2003, to see when the last time I emailed him was. And I don't have any messages to or from him in that time, so it's been a long time since I've known him personally. It was mostly at K-Fest, but when I saw him at K-Fest, I made sure to buy his products every year, even if I'd bought them the year before, because what he gave to this community was just so exhaustive and that he deserved to be supported the same way that he was supporting us, which was without limit. And it's when I got the email, I first heard back in January from Ewan Wanup that he had passed away, because Ewan was one of the last people that Joe saw personally in the Apple II community. And I thought it had to be some sort of mistake, because there had been no news that Joe was literally on his deathbed. But he was a very passionate but also a very personal person, and he kept this mostly to himself. And I'm sorry that it was such a shock to us, because it is a great loss to the community.
Okay. Andy.
It's true. I never got to meet Joe. I did buy a collection of his Shareware Solutions several years ago. It's a wonderful newsletter, and I know it was created and produced right on Apple IIgs, or at least Apple IIs. If you want to read some more stories about Joe. I believe Ken could correct me. The JuiceGS website has the tribute that was written for a recent issue of JuiceGS published up on the website that anybody can download. And I enjoyed reading stories about it, about him that other people wrote. And he certainly was a seemed like a powerful figure and guy who had a lot of influence.
Okay. Yeah, that that tribute was a compilation of essays written by several people in the community that knew him as a user group member, a deadhead, a beta tester, and there were just so many aspects to Joe that I was thrilled to have them submitted to JuiceGS. And I didn't feel it right to share that with just an exclusive group, so that is available at JuiceGS, the website, as a free download. And I also mailed a half dozen copies to Joe's family as well, so that they can learn something about what Joe meant to us.
Okay. Tony?
I first met Joe, I think, had to be the second to last Apple Fest in San Francisco. Maybe the first revival one with the launching of the 2GS, because I think there were two or three up there after that. And then also we all go to the Apple Expos and whatnot. But Joe, first time I met him, it's kind of funny. I wasn't sure what to do with trying to get my stuff out of the Civic Center, and Joe reaches into the back of my truck, takes out a 12-pack of Coke box that's sitting in the back, shoves it over the parking meter, and says, "Now you can park." So we went up and down the escalator and brought the stuff out, and I helped him. He brought his car out, and we did the same thing. We brought his stuff up. And that was before that. I've only read about Joe, read his articles in the magazines and whatnot, and then, you know, of course, I put a name to the face right there. And from then on, you know, fast forwarding a few years, on the road trips to Kansas Fest, Joe would meet me. I would meet him. Some couple of years in a row, we knew we were both inbound. You know, obviously, way before cell phones, and Joe would never have a cell phone anyway. I flew into San Francisco airport one time, and I had the huge Motorola brick phone, a cancer phone. Oops, that's actually not really a good way to put it, but he called it that, you know. And I'm talking to Juwade on the phone, and Joe came to pick me up, and I hand Joe the phone, and the way he looked at it was like, I'm going to talk on a cell phone? You know, Joe lived the simple life. His house still had, to the very end, a rotary dial phone in it. You know, the relatives would wonder if he needed to make a phone call and to call Kaiser or something. You know, press one. Well, what do you do? Well, he'd go in the other room and use the touchtone phone, I guess. But but no, he lived a simple life, and I think because of that, he had a way he could relate to stuff, and he could put things in words in a way that was very unique. And because of that, his writings remain, yes, they were, you know, yes, they were done 15, 20, 10 years ago, but they're still very valid today. And he had a knack of getting the idea, getting the point across. And, you know, back to the Kansas Fest thing, we would be traveling from different directions, we end up on the same interstate. At least two or three times, I'd go into pull into a rest area, and I'd see the brown Corolla, or he'd see me, and here we are. We're both headed there. And one year we hooked up together and decided to drive back most of the way through Kansas in unison, and we went to Hutchinson, Kansas, and he introduced me to the Cosmosphere. He says, "I've always wanted to stop here." And I didn't even know what it was. I looked at him. He says, "You've got to be kidding me. There's a space museum in the middle of Kansas?" And that was 93, I think. It was a small exhibit compared to what it is now. I've gone there every year at least twice, once inbound and once outbound from Kansas City. And, you know, I think of Joe every time I go there, because he was another thing he was very into was the space program. Joe was into a lot of stuff, whenever anything interesting came along software wise that had to do with that, he would make sure to feature it in his newsletters. So it was very surprising to wake up that morning and read the news and thought, I said, what the heck? And I'd only talked to him, you know, a few weeks earlier, and I just, you know, in thinking back, yeah, he kind of alluded to it, but I think he didn't want to be treated any different. And he probably felt that if somebody knew, they're going to treat him somehow differently, and he didn't want that. So his answer was, sit on it and live and just keep on going. And if there's anything to be learned from that, you know, I still haven't quit. It was still quite of a shock to wake up to it, and I still can't not think about it. So.
Okay, and I have to say that I was very surprised to hear of Joe's passing. He was still a very young man, and it was really unfortunate. I do remember that towards the end of Insider A+, his was pretty much the only content worth reading in that magazine at that point, and the early issues of SS2 in particular were really great material. And there really was no bigger advocate for use of the Apple II than Joe Cohn. I think we all lost a good friend to the Apple II when Joe passed on. I also was pretty surprised, as I had said in my part of the GCS tribute to Joe, that I am surprised now. I've run into many people online who didn't know who he was, who are Apple II users, so maybe there's a little bit of the memory of Joel and SS2 that we can share with those who are newer to the community. Okay, on to software in 2009. Lots of reclassifications. Syndicom put out a couple of software collections that are kind of new, or if not software collections, at least some documentation collections. ProTerm 3.1 that we did talk about last year a little bit was reclassified as freeware. Why don't we go ahead and start with Sheppy?
Well, obviously, it's been very interesting, you know, as I alluded to before, that hardware has sort of supplanted software as the area of big creations in the Apple II world. A lot of the biggest software announcements have been kind of reclassifications and compendiums, which has been kind of a growing trend the last few years anyway. Obviously, I'm personally excited about the collections that I've released through Syndicom with the APTA software and reference manual collections in particular, both because I think they're you know, I personally think they're useful products, but also because on a more selfish level, so to speak, it's a lot easier for me to produce these CDs than it is to print out all of these books and ship those to people. I mean, I've had orders that weighed like 16 or 17 pounds of these printed books to ship out, so it's kind of a relief to be like, oh, I just ship it on a CD, and that's awesome. For people who still want the books, I still do that, but it's nice that I have fewer orders that involve shipping massive amounts of dead trees across the country or around the world. And obviously, you know, ProTerm 3.1 being reclassified is fantastic, just because it is, I think, probably the best telecommunications program ever released for the Apple II. There are certainly some that come close, or maybe in some circles surpass it. Spectrum obviously is extremely powerful, but as just a general Apple II product, I think, you know, overall, when you consider, you know, how much more broadly compatible it is, I think ProTerm kind of outweighs it in that regard. And that's a fantastic thing to have reclassified. So.
Okay. Sean Fahey.
Well, I I really can't say anything more than what Sheppy just said.
Okay. Ken?
Well, as we've already said, there continue to be updates to software like Virtual 2 and Suite 16. Jeff Fink just came out with a new version of Silver and Castle, the first new version in 2 years. And I went to his website, and there was no documentation about what has changed, but the fact that he's still updating an RPG that I first reviewed for Juice GS more than 10 years ago is just astounding. Even there's new software coming out from people who have never published software before either. I think the first release from Martin Hay just came out a week or two ago. He released his own operating system. If people want to write programs for an extremely bare-bones system running off a 5 1/4-inch floppy disk, you can use Martin's Naked OS. And he also has a programming assistant or a tool called Supermon, which is like a super monitor to help you write code. And it's just great that we continue to see, even in the face of a shift to the hardware side, new software continuing to come out.
Okay. Andy?
One software program that stood out for me, not for the Apple II, but it helps with the Apple II. It's Kelvin Sherlock, who's been a prolific program writer for years. He put out that the ProFuse product, which is a way to get the Mac OS or Linux system to actually add ProDOS support right to the modern OS, so that you wouldn't need an emulator to read ProDOS images. You wouldn't need to use CiderPress or standalone utility. And it's interesting to me that that's the direction he's going in with this product. And you know, I know it's write or read only at this point, but how neat would that be that we could use Apple II software in Windows and Mac OS at the file system level, be able to work with files. It would just extend it, I think, and make it easier for people to use this stuff in the future without having to learn how to use specific programs or emulators.
Okay. Is ProFuse still read-only?
I don't know. I know that he's still it's still being developed, and if you check the website, you know, he's making code updates all the time, but I couldn't find anything that said that he added the write ability to the file system, but I could be wrong.
Because I remember it was actually on this Roundtable podcast last year that its release was announced, but I haven't had much use to follow its progress since then, so I may have missed something.
Okay. Tony.
Well, let's see here. Where we start? You know, it's a little bit of lost classics again here, from my perspective. ProTerm. I'll add a little something about ProTerm. You know, everybody says, oh, it's the greatest communications program. I think it's the greatest word processor. I can't tell you how much stuff I'd write in ProTerm. I'd sit and do everything in ProTerm, and then I'd paste it into AppleWorks or paste it into something else to do it. But I'd do all the text in ProTerm first. And that even carried on to the Mac side. You know, we can't run Classic anymore, so we can't run ProTerm Mac. But the same thing, we used to use the editor there for typing everything in and working on stuff, and then move it somewhere else. And ProTerm was a really, really excellent addition to the Lost Classics project, and it was probably the catapult to get the website up and going again as well. And with that, I'd like to add that the Shareware Solutions 2 newsletters are also available on the Lost Classics project now as well, and finally released this morning, which everybody probably knows about by the time they hear the podcast anyway, but what the heck, you know. bringing those to fruition and here you go, here's your rights, here's your permission, you can release this now, the community can have it, that's fine, but getting it in a presentable form that does it justice is a lot of work behind the scenes, and it's worth every second spent on it, because it's nice just to see something live on and go forward and be available.
Okay. All I really have to add as someone who also writes a little bit of code himself is I'm really glad to see any kind of new Apple II software or reclassified Apple II software. Anything to keep things going, I think, is very appreciated. Okay, and our last topic for this evening before we give our picks is something kind of near and dear to my heart. Juicy Magazine passes Softdisk as the longest-running Apple II publication of all time. Eric Shepard.
You know, I never saw it coming, and I mean that in two ways. I mean, during the time when I was, you know, more directly involved in the production of Juice.js back when Syndicom used to publish it, you know, I certainly did not at the time have any expectation that it would outlast anything. I mean, it was always very much a, you know, we'll decide each year if we're going to be able to publish it another year. And so it's a pleasant surprise on that front. And then again, it's a surprise just in that, or a pleasant surprise in that I was taken by surprise, but just because I hadn't realized that it was that some of those other publications had not been published longer than they were. For some reason, I just think of, for example, Nibble having been published like forever, you know. And so when I realized that we had passed the Nibble, which I think is now the third longest or so published Apple II publication, it's mind-boggling to me, really. And I think it's awesome. I think it's a testament not just to the quality of the publication, but also to the hard work of everybody involved, and the fact that frankly it's done very cost effectively, which makes it a lot more realistic to keep the publication going. So I think that's great. I think it's awesome.
Okay. Sean
V. I just think it's great that, you know, in the internet age, when everything's published online, I can still get a periodical in the mail that I can hold in my hands and I can read through it. And, you know, it's not a very big periodical. It's I could probably read the entire content slowly and over the period of an hour, but I'm going to actually reread it several times, and it's something that I look forward to getting every time it's published. And I just congratulate Ken and Sheppy and everyone who's involved with the magazine for doing such a wonderful job, and congratulate Max Jones for starting it way back in the day. It's a great magazine, and anyone who isn't subscribing, I really encourage you to do so.
Okay. Speaking of Juice.js, publisher and editor-in-chief, Ken Gagne.
Well, I was both amused and a little bit embarrassed that, but also very much appreciative when Sean brought it to our attention that this was now the longest-running Apple II publication, because, as Sheppy said, it hadn't occurred to any of us. We so often just have our heads down trying to get the next issue out that we didn't even realize we'd crossed a milestone. And it's amazing to realize that this happened to a publication that was launched after the last Apple II had already rolled off the line. I can't help but think what would have happened if we had launched this magazine, you know, 15 years earlier during the publication's heyday, how many more people would be reading it. But on the other hand, I think that is one of the reasons that it's still around, is because we never expected to generate tons of revenue in advertisement, to have thousands of readers. We've always been a very streamlined and bare-bones publication, and that really hasn't changed in the last 15 years. We've been pretty consistent about what we have to work with and what we're trying to do, which is one of the reasons I think we've been able to last so long. And another reason is because so many members of the community have been so supportive. Our subscriptions numbers have been going up for several years straight, and the community is also volunteering to support the publication with their writing. There isn't a person on this podcast this evening that hasn't written for Juice.js at some point. And we have more writers showing up all the time. We just added two more back in September, Ivan Drucker and Martin Hay. We have Antoine writing for us regularly, even though he's not on staff. We have another writer debuting in the next issue, although he's not officially on staff. And it's I always said that Juice.js would stop printing not when we run out of money, but when we run out of things to write about. And we just published a 24-page issue, which is longer than we usually do, and I had to, you know, delay three or four different articles for the next issue because I couldn't fit even those. So I'm just incredibly enthusiastic and optimistic about things right now, and I really appreciate everybody giving me the opportunity to put this magazine out so regularly.
Okay. Andy Malloy.
Malloy.
Andy?
Oh, sorry about that. One thing that's really positive about JuiceGS is that if you read an article in there that you like, and there's an author maybe you follow, there's a good chance that if you go to KFest that that author will also be at KFest. So these are people who are involved in the community and are sharing info in many different forums. And they're doing it internationally. They're doing it right here in the U.S. And it's just more than just a magazine. It's part of the community. I think it's embedded in the community. And it was something that first got me back into the Apple II. And, you know, I was kind of came a lot later than many of you. I was in around 2000 when I came into it. And JuiceGS was one of the first things I found through Sheppy and Syndicom. And, you know, you can get back issue CD-ROM compilations, and it goes all the way back to 95, and it's a great way to catch up if you haven't been in a while. And I just really recommend going to the website, because there is a lot of info there on the legacy of the magazine.
Okay. Tony?
I have to echo what's been said, primarily on the, you know, Sheppy mentioned, it came out of nowhere that it's the last remaining one, and I think Ken meant during the heyday of the platform, not during the heyday of the publication, when he talked about if it had come out.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah. But anyway, the being part of the JuiceGS staff puts me in an interesting predicament, because while I can read the drafts as they come along, I don't like to, because I want to read it on paper. I like to get the paper and read it. It's, as Sean said, you really can't get it. There's something to be said about sitting there holding it, looking at it, as opposed to holding the button down and dragging the scroll bar on a PDF. It's more interesting to read the paper. And I think, like Ken said, you quit writing when there's nothing to write about. I don't see that happening anytime soon. It just with all the developments, somebody comes along, gets interested in the platform, you know, you may feel that, oh my gosh, what are we going to do to put this issue together? But everything comes together, and you get enough content every time. And you've got a backlog of stuff to work with. So, you know, I think we'll probably be here many more years doing that.
What I have to say, being somebody who was involved with JuiceGS from the beginning and still occasionally contributes an article or two, is that I think Max Jones is owed a lot of debt by this community for creating a really timeless publication that, if you look in terms of appearance, really hasn't changed very much over 15 years. The basic layout is still largely the same, even though it's gone from one platform to another in terms of its production, even though it's gone through three editors in chief and three different publishers. It's a pretty amazing publication just in the way that it's put together and its consistency in terms of getting out there. And I think it's just a really incredible achievement, and it's even more incredible when you consider that I don't think that there's an end in sight that any of us can think about. And, you know, this is kind of psyching me up to try and write some more articles for JuiceGS that I haven't been doing as frequently as I used to. Okay, so we're going to end this annual show by going around, and everyone, give us your pick for the year. Give us something that you think would be a great Apple II user's website or product or just about anything. We'll go ahead and start with Sheppy.
You know, that's a tough one because it's I don't know that I have a product per se in mind, more an idea. All I can think is to be very, very upbeat about the hardware development side of things. And while I don't really necessarily have a product in particular I would like to plug or recommend, I think that just being able to watch as the hardware kind of starts to coalesce, and all these little projects, or in some cases very big projects, are kind of coming together. I think over the next year, that's going to be where the real excitement is. I think that on the software side, I think some of the so-called or kind of seemingly smaller projects are going to have the most long-term win for the community. Profuse, obviously, I think is going to be one of the big ones. And although it's not an Apple II product per se, I think anything that makes it easier to work with Apple IIs in a multi-platform environment like that, being able to access your ProDOS content on your Mac, your Linux machine, I think is obviously a big win.
Okay. And let's move on to Sean Feeney.
Well, you know, I really like the Apple II GS. I use one, but my real love is the Apple IIe. And so I have a lot of empathy for 8-bit applications. And I really think this VM02 that I talked about a little bit earlier, I'm really looking forward to seeing that embraced as a way of bringing the 8-bit Apple II up to you know, getting it onto the internet a little easier than has been, you know, basically the only option before was Contiki, and not a lot's been going on in the Contiki front lately. So I'm really looking forward to maybe VM02 making the 8-bit Apple IIs more internet-enabled. A whole new class of applications being rolled out, getting more people developing for that platform. Basically, I think there's going to be a lot of energy there.
Okay. Ken Gagne.
Well, when I saw Vince Briel's MP3 card at Kansas Fest 2009, I had to echo the sentiment that one of the members of the audience asked, which was, how are you so awesome? I mean, I have some experience with MP3 players with the Apple II GS, and I didn't think it could be done. So for him to one-up me like that was just one of the most welcome sights I could ever see.
I think you messed up Tony's monitor again.
Oh, dear. Sorry, Tony. Well, at least you know how to de-yellow it.
I think that's a triple shot right there.
Yeah, I'm gonna fix this all in post. Okay. Anything else, Ken?
I'm trying to finish. In Juice GS, I estimated that the MP3 card would be available by end of year 2009. That hasn't happened, and I assume that's because he's making it even awesomer. So I'm looking forward to see what he does with it, and I'm most likely going to be in line to buy one.
I have news on that. He's working. He's finishing up his mini Altair project. When that's done, he's going to turn his attention back to the MP3 card.
Okay. Thank you, Sean, for the update.
Yay.
Okay. Andy Malloy.
One project that I guess I'd plug, though, mainly just from being a fan of it, is the A2GS.com, which is the Apple IIGS laptop project. And the blog updates are pretty regular. The idea is to try to make a portable Apple IIGS, so I think that's something that, you know, will we see it in 2010? I think that would be fun if it came to fruition. And secondly, I just picked up a new little hardware gadget called the FC5025. And what it does is it lets you connect an old 5 1/4 floppy disk from a PC to USB. And the software actually lets you read Apple II disks as well as Commodore disks and everything else. And I've been using it to try to get disk images off my old Apple II disks. And it's been fun. It's not much money. And if anybody's interested, Device Side Data is the guys who are putting it out. That's something maybe I hope we could see a review of in Juice GS come this year.
Okay.
Oh, it's happening. It's happening.
It's happening. Okay. You heard it here first. And if he's back from wiping up his monitor, Tony Diaz.
The monitor and a Mac LC. I put the Coke on the other side of the room. I won't use it now.
Good call.
Without the community, giving feedback without the community using the fruits that the rest of us have developed and that they've put input into to bring them to bring them to development. I think none of us would be here. It's a two-way street. If there's anything I have to pick, it's the community as a whole, and for still, you know, for going on this long, and again with seemingly no end in sight, and as well the legacy of Joe Cohn's newsletter, Joe Cohn's writings, and his products moving forward. Without, you know, and of course, would have been nice to have brought them to us in another way, but, you know, I think that's where, if I had anything to pick, that's where I'd be putting it on right now.
Okay. And my pick for 2010 is Juice GS, the current volume. We've already seen the first issue of this volume come in at 24 pages, and like Ken said, he had to delay some material, and I'm looking forward to another great year of reading about the Apple II. Okay, I'd like to thank everybody for taking some time this Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening to hang out with us and share their bits on the Apple II. We'll just go around, and if anybody has anything to plug, be it self-serving or not, you can go ahead and do so. Eric Shepherd of Syndicom. Sheffy, thanks for being here.
No problem. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. Anything to plug?
Nope, not that I haven't already plugged.
Okay.
Apple II forever.
Apple II forever. Yes. Sean Fahey of A2Central.com.
Apple II forever, so say we all.
Okay.
So say we all.
Ken Gagne of Juice GS Magazine.
Well, thank you for having another year of A2 Unplugged, Ryan, and I look forward to seeing as many of you as possible at Kansas Fest this year. Our keynote speaker is Mark Simonson, former president of Beagle Brothers, which I think is going to be a fantastic and historical session. And we're also going to have the iPad there, so if you couldn't get your hands on one today, come to K-Fest and take a look at it there.
Okay. Andy Beloy, also Juicy S Magazine.
Yeah, I just want to thank you, Ryan, for pulling this together again. I think it's a great that you keep your podcast going. Maybe you're the only one left that's regularly putting out an Apple II-related podcast, but I thank you for that.
Okay, you're welcome. And finally, Tony Diaz of 16SecTerror, Apple2.org, Apple2.info.
I'd like to say just keep serious and stay in focus.
Okay. Thank you all. I hope you have a good night, and I'm sure our listenership thanks you as well. Great for another year. Thanks, guys.
And that's our show for this episode. I would like to thank all of you out there for putting up with some of our poor technical quality this time around. I apologize again for that, as well as our panel. That would be Tony Diaz of Apple2.org, Apple2.info, 16sector.com, Eric Shepherd, Sheppy from Syndicom, Sean Fahey of A2Central.com, and Andy Malloy and Ken Gagne of JuiceGS Magazine. Thank you all for participating. Hope to do this again with you next year. Ma'alama pono, a hui ho. Take care, everyone, and good night.